The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on the show, visit kuci.org. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI in Irvine. This is In the Garden with your host, Bill Brooks, University of California Master Gardener. We're talking to Master Gardener Kelly Osborne today. Kelly is a credentialed teacher. She has a master's in education technology, and she is a newly elected school board member in the Laguna Beach Unified School District. She's going to give us some insight on making a school garden part of the school's culture as well as part of the curriculum. Welcome, Kelly. Please tell us a little more about yourself.
Well, thanks so much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, I am a teacher and an outdoor educator, and I've been working in the Laguna Beach Unified School District for about 6 years, leading their outdoor classroom program. I'm also a master gardener, went through my master gardener training a couple years back, and a mom of two boys.
So a lot of schools have gardens. It seems to be the thing to do these days, but often a garden is started with a lot of enthusiasm, and then in a couple of years, it's nothing but weeds. It's no longer being used. You have a vibrant program at Top of the World Elementary School that's existed for quite a few years. How does a school accomplish this?
Oh yeah, it's such a great question. And I agree, you know, starting a garden is a lot of work and effort, but the maintenance of that program and sustaining the garden program is definitely much more work. And that's oftentimes why you do see some of those programs fall by the wayside. Here at Top of the World Elementary School, you know, we have a lot of programs and systems that help our garden program sustain over the years. So when we'll talk more about this in the show, but, you know, first and foremost, the garden is really integrated into the educational practices of the school. And that's probably the most critical part of how you can have these vibrant programs. You know, schools are there to educate the students, so the garden really needs to support that mission. Another way that the school needs to kind of sustain the program is thinking about what maintenance needs to be done to keep that garden in good shape. Teaching students in a garden is much different than what needs to be done in terms of whether that's pruning or weeding or raking. You know, there needs to be a plan for that. In our program, we have a really simple month-by-month checklist of all the things that need to get done. And oftentimes, we'll have some support from teachers and students, but we have a very large volunteer base that comes out to help us maintain that program. And we document things. You know, we document exactly what it takes so that it's easy to repeat those steps the next year.
And I think you even said you had buy-in from your school custodian.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, it's a real all-hands-on-deck program from the principal to every classroom teacher to, you know, each of the custodians. You really need to, you know, have everybody behind the garden. And when it's well-maintained, it's a real source of pride for all the members of the school community.
So as making a school garden part of your school's culture, as well as the instructional program and curriculum, your school does have a website people can go to, and it's very easy to remember. It's TOW, T-O-W, garden, one word, .org. The website talks about the outdoor classroom. So tell us a little bit about what is an outdoor classroom.
Yeah, you know, an outdoor classroom really goes beyond just a school garden, right? A school garden is a set of, you know, garden boxes or some trees with some plants in it. But an outdoor classroom is where students can come and actually learn successfully in that space. Our outdoor classroom has curriculum that goes with it. And it also has things that you would find in a traditional classroom that make learning conducive, like seating, like shade, like storage. You know, you never could, you wouldn't walk into a traditional classroom and not see a place for students even to sit or to store their belongings. And so the concept of an outdoor classroom is that we can take students into nature and have them learn some really, rigorous curriculum, but have it been done in a way that is really in a classroom setting. And so, you know, our program over many years has evolved into this concept of, you know, taking that learning outside. And that's really what we mean when we say an outdoor classroom.
Wonderful. So author Richard Loewe talks about a nature deficit disorder. What is a nature deficit disorder? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, this is a great author and book. It was a term that was coined back in 2005 with Loewe's, I mean, fantastic book, Last Child in the Woods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he uses it to describe, you know, some of the really positive effects that come out of being in nature, especially for children. And by the same token, some of the negative effects that we see when children are deprived of experiences in nature. And, you know, he really goes into why there are less opportunities for children to be in nature with, you know, some urban, you know, planning reasons and lots of reasons. But the bottom line is that, you know, in this kind of seminal work, he shared that when children lack time and experience in nature, that we see effects of, you know, more obesity, you know, diminished use of their senses, higher rates of illness and attention difficulties. And so, you know, the concept that we have a deficit in being in nature kind of really took hold, and the international community kind of rallied around trying to get children back into nature. And, you know, it's as simple as having, you know, children still having recess, you know, in some schools recess was cut. You know, and in our school, it really means being out in nature, being surrounded by trees and plants and really studying them up close.
So we're lucky enough to be at the campus today, which is in a beautiful setting. It's on top of a hilltop between the Pacific Ocean and the rest of Orange County here at Top of the World Elementary. And your space looks like it's pretty close to an acre in size. It's a big space. So if you could describe the garden for our listeners, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, and you know, as we're sitting out here having this conversation, you know, we're hearing, you know, the birds up in the eucalyptus tree. You know, we're close to some, you know, lavender and Cleveland sage that maybe has some bees buzzing around it. And that's what it's really like for our students when they're out here. It's quiet and they can hear the sounds of nature. They can hear the tree leaves rustling. They can hear some of the, you know, the insects or the birds out there. But, you know, and that's, you know, to your prior question, that's really what we're trying to address, right? Being out in nature and connecting with it. But specifically the space, we actually have three garden spaces on our elementary school campus. We serve K through 5. The one that we're sitting in today, yes, is quite large. It's about an acre. We have 25 fruit trees up here. Ranging from
wow.
Citrus to guava, some avocados, peach, apricot, pomegranate, all kinds of different trees. We also have about 40 raised beds where we grow our annual vegetables. And then we have a variety of themed or thematic gardens that correspond to our curriculum. For example, a fire safe garden that we use when learning about some of the, you know, natural hazards out there, like wildfires. We have a California-themed garden that our fourth graders grow that focuses on California-specific plants like artichokes and garlic. We have a pollinator garden. We have a wellness garden. And woven into all of that focus on the plants and the trees is really the concept of a classroom. You know, we have a large seating area where you could seat a class of 30 mm-hmm. students. We have an area that, for those educators out there, would be conducive for direct instruction, where all students are facing forward. We have pathways that help students know where to go and help lead them safely amongst the garden. And that's our space.
And so you have some garden boxes for vegetables. So tell us a little bit more. We looked at a healing garden, for example. What's in the healing garden and what is that like?
Yeah, you know, that was a really fun program. Now, you know, in managing a school garden program, we try and kind of take on one big new thing a year. And maybe it was 2 or 3 years back, I had a group of parents that wanted to grow this wellness garden or a medicine garden. And that has things, you know, some herbs, you know, like sage, oregano, thyme, lemon verbena. It has other really interesting plants like calendula that has a lot of uses, you know, in salves, you know, maybe for chapstick or for some other healing types of properties. We have lemongrass, just some interesting plants. Then, you know, what we've done for the students is we, you know, we have printed up cards that share the history of each of those plants and what types of ailments, whether it's maybe, you know, helps them maybe sleep at night better or maybe helps them with an upset tummy. We've printed that information out on some of the plant markers as well.
So do students actually get to try any of these medicinal herbs and things that are growing?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, I think we've made them into teas, you know, iced tea, where they'll take lemon verbena and put it into tea bags and we'll infuse a tea. You know, most of them are edible right off the plant, and so they can taste them as well. Of course, we have, you know, lots of the mints spreading out of control up there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful garden. And did you say you had, how many vegetable boxes do you have?
We have about 40 total.
Wow, that's incredible.
And, you know, with those, you know, those are again, it's a school garden, so we try and focus on the fall, the winter, and the early spring growing months. So, you know, we'll see a lot of root vegetables, starting with carrots and beets, to lettuces, chards, kales, and then usually by the spring, about March, we'll put in fava beans, garlic, onions, things like that. We'll do, over the summer, we'll put in some sweet potato slips, so we have sweet potatoes in the fall. We actually skip the summer, the traditional summer vegetables mostly.
So there's probably no pizza gardens here, which is your basil and your tomatoes and your oreganos.
You know, I stopped growing large tomatoes because I found that, you know, growing a cherry tomato plant in a school garden is so much more effective. The kids can just pick the tomato right off the plant and eat it, and it doesn't get all over their shirt like it would on a larger, heavier tomato, and there's more to go around. So, you know, school gardens really kind of need to reframe the growing experience around the child, right, versus maybe as adults we might make different choices.
Because when we were walking around touring, you mentioned that you want things that can be easily picked and eaten on the spot, where they can quickly wash it off and pop something in their mouth. So a cherry tomato would definitely fit that bill, but you've got to have an abundance of produce here. So what do you do with everything growing in the garden?
Oh gosh, yeah, good question. So we, you know, what they can't just eat off the plant and take care of, you know, that that's the primary focus, the students right from the plant into the mouth. Beyond that, we take the produce to the cafeteria. You know, we have a great persimmon tree, and you know, the nutrition department usually doesn't source persimmons. They're, you know, they're pricey and hard to procure. And they really look forward to putting those on the salad bar or putting them out for students in the traditional cafeteria lunch line. And then same thing, you know, any lettuces we might have, extra oranges, typically go to our school cafeteria. And they have these great little cards on the salad bar that say, you know, they were grown in the school garden here. And that makes the kids really excited to pick that and try it.
That's wonderful that the school cafeteria actually uses the food that you grow. And then I noticed on your website that to raise money, you actually do a farmer's market. Tell us a little bit about your farmer's markets.
Oh, yeah. So in the fall, which is one of our biggest markets because it precedes the Thanksgiving holiday, we have the kids, they do a math lesson to pick and price all of the produce. You know, at that time of year, we have our pomegranates, talked about the persimmons, the sweet potatoes. We have a lot of our citrus, you know, our mandarin oranges, lemons, limes. And the kids pick all of that. And they set their prices and they present to the group what they're going to charge. And, you know, we get it all set up for the school community to come and purchase that produce. It's really wild. You know, some years we've raised occasionally we'll do them again in the winter and the spring, but we'll raise on upwards of $4,000 for the program.
Whoa, that's amazing. So yeah. So that's something else if you're listening and you're thinking about your own school garden, to think about a source for income to put back in, because gardens are expensive. You have to replant every year. You have to update your soils and things. And so it's a very good idea. So thank you for sharing that with us. So do you grow from seeds or do you buy pre-started plants?
So we do both. We have a greenhouse, an 18-foot diameter geodesic greenhouse. And when we added that, it was through a grant from a company called Seeds of Change. And that really helped us expand how much we could grow from seed. It's really hard to grow things from seed unless you have proper propagation spaces, mm-hmm. especially at the level that we were needing. You know, we have 600 students on campus. You know, every single one of those 600 students comes into our garden, you know, every month, and many of them come every week at lunch. So we need a lot of plant material. So for propagation from seed, we do that in our greenhouse with easy to propagate things. You know, peas are a great example, chard. We'll save some seeds from prior seasons to start again. But then we also start from seedlings as well. In our first and second grade garden, we find that having a little plant seedling that's ready to go and has a more immediate gratification works really well for that age group. And some of our older students, you know, because they get involved in not just the seed starting, but then the upplanting, right? Sizing mm-hmm. it up to a bigger container, and then the transplanting gives them what we call more seed impressions.
I see.
Right? Because they get to handle that process more times than they would if it was just a nursery grown starter.
So the geodome that the school has, is it's very creative. I love the shape. It's dome-like. It has a pond inside of it. What's the purpose of the pond inside your greenhouse?
So the pond is part of the overall passive solar design.
Mm-hmm.
And the pond helps regulate the temperature in the greenhouse. So in the winter, the water stays warm in that pond, warmer than maybe the air temperature, and helps kind of heat up the greenhouse. And in the summer, the pond water helps keep the temperature down in the greenhouse. So it kind of regulates the temperature. And it also is just a great teaching item
mm-hmm.
because it allows the students to connect the all of the solar concepts that are going on in that greenhouse with, you know, whether it's, you know, the solar panels that are on top of the greenhouse or the passive solar elements with the position of it, you know, in the space and the north-facing walls and, you know, just gives us a lot of really robust real-world phenomenon to share with our students.
Yeah, Kelly even mentioned when she showed me the greenhouse that it has pistons that are filled with beeswax that contract and expand with heat so that it opens the panels to let hot air out and cool air in, which was, I thought, an amazing feature, especially for kids to see, because it starts at thinking outside of the box, which I think is so important. So do you buy your seeds? Do you like to get them online or do you just get them at a local garden center?
We do a variety. We get a lot of donations, and that's part of maintaining a robust program, is you do have to find those sources that might be willing to donate. You know, in a school garden, you go through a lot of seeds. You know, mm-hmm. a lot don't germinate. Everybody wants to have seeds to plant. You always plant more than you might mm-hmm. otherwise as a home gardener. And so, you know, we typically get donations as they might be nearing their expiration date. Even our local hardware store knows to save their inventory as they near that expiration date and give them to us.
Oh, very good.
There might be something that we need. Maybe we need another pack of California poppy right at the moment before it's going to rain, and we'll go down to the store and buy those too.
Okay. So you said you gathered some seeds. Give me some examples of the plant species where you gather seeds from.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And, you know, the great thing that I want to plug here is that the student, the child, you know, they really start to see how they can connect the fact that the plant not only produces something edible for them to eat, but then maybe after that point, you know, produces the seed for them to then grow the plant again. Mm-hmm. It's really an eye-opening moment when they figure that out. Some of the things that we like to save seeds from are rainbow chard plants. Make a nice large, you know, large enough to handle for a, you know, a 7 or 8 year old's fingertip seed. Peas, fava beans will save seeds from, radish as well. So a lot of the larger, you know, easy to
handle. Gather seeds you can. And that's amazing because then it's teaching students the entire process, the circle, so to speak.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to be willing to let some of your plants, you know, go into that kind of mangly stage. I know I've heard of some school gardens that have a bed that's just dedicated to seed production. Mm-hmm. So nobody's tempted to maybe pick those prior to that phase of their cycle.
So so many people involved, who makes the decision on what to grow? You said a little bit that you want to make sure that things are ripe and harvested during the months school's in. So you've skipped the summer month. Typical produce, the hot weather produce. So who makes, tell us a little more about the decisions.
Yeah, and you know, we lay it out on a calendar. You know, once you figure things out, I always advise people that are interested in school gardens, just write it down and document it so you don't have to figure that out again next year. Right, you know,
good idea.
Gardening is really seasonal and what we're doing in the fall is different from what we're doing in the spring. So we use just a month-by-month sheet, and we tend to plant the same things each month that we know work. And that really helps us keep it simple and not get, make the same mistakes twice. So, you know, the carrots, the beets, the lettuces that maybe we start with in the fall, you know, there's 4 or 5 of those things, and we do that planting cycle. And then in the winter, we come with another planting cycle. In the spring, you know, 2 or 3 more things. So we don't get too, especially on the annuals, we don't get too crazy, you know, with that, because we want to,
we want it to work.
We want it to work. Mm-hmm. We want to have some success. And with seeds, the students really need to be able to handle the size. I mean, I have first graders, and when we do those carrots from seed, you know, you give them a handful of carrot seeds and you turn around and they're blowing in the wind. So
yeah. So if you don't mind sharing with us some things that haven't worked out well for you.
So, one year I was working with the middle school students. I was working with the history teacher. We were doing a lesson on ancient civilization and some of the ancient grains, ancient crops. And so we wanted to try some new things that were out of my zone, you know, that were, you know, maybe in the Mesopotamia time frame. Uh-huh. And she and I had done some research, and we wanted the kids to try planting lentils and flax and maybe some peas. Those were of that time period. And, you know, they grew, but I wouldn't say that we ever got, you know, maybe more than 15 lentils. And the flax was pretty, but, you know.
Right.
The kids were like, can we eat it? You know.
You're not going to weave clothes or cloth out of it, that's for sure.
Yeah, so sometimes we do things that have an educational component, and it's really more about the process than the product. So that's one example. And then we talked about, sometimes we've been eager or very excited at the end of the school year and want to put those watermelons in, we really, in a school garden setting, try and give our gardens a little bit of a rest in the summer, you know, and let our volunteers recharge and let our staff recharge. And, sometimes when we've had big ambitions about summer crops, we, you know, have decided not to do that again the next year.
Let them go.
Yeah.
Yes. I see. Have you ever tried pumpkins?
So pumpkins are the exception because they're a May start and they're an
October harvest.
So they're perfect. You just kind of got to get them going before you give yourself, as a school garden coordinator, that kind of summer break.
Yes, because you don't want to be up here. I mean, you need a break, obviously.
Yeah.
Are there any other features? You told us a lot about the gardens, but any other features in this outdoor space that we might want to touch upon? We're at a wonderful picnic table for our interview, and there's about 8 of them, which is perfect learning space and space for students to sit and relax in another outdoor classroom. So anything else that you do that we didn't cover?
You know, when I've met with other school gardens or, you know, groups of other teachers or school principals about, you know, how to make a really good garden program, I talk a lot about a couple S's. One is seating, right? So really think about where your student's going to sit when you want to just share with them what the plan is before everybody gets up to go do something. Shade, you know, here in our mild climate, we have year-round sun, and we really need shade to be able
yes,
to
we do.
To be in an outdoor classroom setting, you know, for 60 to 90 minutes. So I don't know if I'd call those exciting, but, you know, they're kind of fun to plan out. And they can be as simple as picnic tables or tree stumps. We use hay bales for seeding, very cheap seeding. And when it falls apart, you can mulch your garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
So those are some features that when thinking about how to keep a school garden program going, you really need to address. The other exciting thing that we focus a lot in is signage. So we have, you know, signs for, you know, a lot of our perennial plants that even have a QR code.
Mm.
You know, and the students can scan that and learn more about the plant, or a parent volunteer could scan that. And, you know, signage is another kind of important S in our garden. So
that's awesome. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, visit kuci.org. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI in Irvine. This is In the Garden, and we're talking about school gardens becoming part of the school's culture and curriculum with our guest, Kelly Osborne. So Kelly, we touched on this, and I definitely want to know more for our listeners about the partnerships that you've developed in the garden to keep this operating. So talk a little bit about those partnerships and how you went about developing them.
Yeah, so we have about, you know, 6 to 8 key partners. And I would say first and foremost, you know, our school PTA. You know, most school PTAs have fundraisers they do each year. They have an annual source of funding. And our garden program became an annual source of spending some of that money, and then also doing some of our own fundraising. That has to be a core connection, because it connects you with the families at the school and is really a cornerstone of family engagement. We also are engaged with our local garden club. We have, you know, we have friends like you at the Master Gardeners and many others that help us on technical issues. You know, maybe a struggling avocado tree or a gopher program or a gopher problem. But we have our local Laguna Beach Garden Club that provides us annual funding as well. And we have a couple partnerships over the years with other large grant sources like Whole Foods, Seeds of Change, where we'll write grants and receive, you know, some funding for different things. Not to be overlooked is the relationship at any school with the company that's providing the landscape maintenance.
Whether that's the school district itself or an independent contractor.
Correct.
Because you mentioned on the tour, tell us a little bit about what the school district is willing to do for you in your garden space.
Yeah, you know, this is just like the school field or any classroom. You know, the students are here and learning. So our landscape management company, you know, likes to keep it, you know, raked. They like to keep, you know, certain perennials pruned for us. If we have a lot of debris from a big work cleanup day that we did with families, they'll help us take that out. Sometimes they'll come and attend those days. And these would be the companies like Brightview or Park West or any landscape company that's providing services to the school district. And they're very knowledgeable, and they become part of the culture of the garden.
Yeah, and you also said that because you're in the wildlands up here, have an issue with rattlesnakes, and so the garden is fenced, but the school district put some fencing or some wire down underneath the fence to keep the rattlesnakes out, so they became part of that too.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I guess it goes without saying, the first and foremost, you know, your main partnership is that school, you know, principal, district, teaching staff. That's an integrated piece to the garden. And you know, we're just really thankful for all those partners. Even back when we, maybe it's been 6 or 7 years now, we partnered with the local ecology center down in San Juan Capistrano.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped us redesign our space to look at the garden and develop kind of a master plan to really make it a beautiful space.
Wonderful. So we have to think outside the box. We have to start thinking of these gardens as classroom space. And I like that. That's an excellent takeaway from today. During your tenure at Top of the World Elementary School, you led the team that earned the school to be designated as a U.S. Department of Education Green Ribbon School. Tell us about what it means to be a Green Ribbon School.
So this is a designation, again, from the U.S. Department of Ed. It's, you know, about a 1 to 2 year process to apply for the designation. And really what it means is that this is a school or a district that's committed to do three things. One, reduce their environmental impact and cost. And that could be, you know, reducing, you know, using more energy efficient HVAC systems. Mm-hmm. That could be planting throughout the campus, not just in the garden. This is the whole school. Maybe planting more native plants and reducing their water mm-hmm. use. The second thing is that a school that's designated Green Ribbon is committed to improving the health and wellness of school students and staff. And what's interesting about this could even cross over into providing social emotional learning for kids. This could be providing, you know, health and wellness benefits to staff. This is, you know, providing maybe a lunchtime garden club. So really, really broad. And the third and final pillar of that program is providing effective environmental education. And that's really what we're talking about here today. You know, is there a consistent way that students, all students at a site or in a district, are receiving environmental education? And it's really a wonderful program. You know, you can apply for it, and just through the process of applying for it, the school will really learn so much about what they're doing, what more they could do, and it really can be kind of a journey for a school that wants to improve in those areas.
So how did the garden spaces, as well as your outdoor classroom here at Top of the World Elementary School, help you with the school's Green Ribbon designation?
You know, I think it was one of those driving forces. Our program has a lot of momentum. We have a really large space, and it's really well integrated into the students' curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it helped meet a lot of the required measures, you know, like, you know, regular environmental education provided to all students. You know, also, you know, nutrition education is a component of that. Mm-hmm. So the fact that students were able to taste persimmons fresh off the tree, or, you know, have some rainbow chard on the school cafeteria salad bar, those were all criteria, you know, that you earn different scoring points for in that application.
So do you do any off-campus outdoor education at all at Top of the World?
We definitely do. And again, you know, the program is more than just a garden. It talks about field trips, you know. So, you know, in our application, we'll talk about, you know, different classroom field trips, maybe to the mission, or mm-hmm. over to the Nick's Nature Center, or, you know, the fifth graders used to take a nature hike at the end of their years down into Aliso Wood Canyons, and all of those are part of the program.
The components that you can do. Do your fifth graders do sleepaway outdoor school at all?
You know, in Laguna Beach Unified, that sleepaway program is in sixth grade, so it's at the Thurston Middle School.
Okay, so it's in middle school. Mm-hmm. So how do you get teacher buy-in with outdoor learning and a school garden?
Oh gosh, that's such a great question. You know, some of the easy ways, all of our garden spaces become a great space for staff to eat lunch in. They're just a beautiful space for, you know, teachers to take a break from the day and sit out and be outside and maybe be visiting with their peers. That was one kind of prong of having the garden be a space for staff on the campus. And again, providing shade for them to be in the garden. We provide, you know, once every month, we provide kind of a brown bag lunch. You know, we set up a time that everybody, teachers can all come and be together in the garden. So that's one prong of it. With the curriculum, a lot of it is really kind of co-teaching. So as an outdoor educator, you know, my job is to work with them with what they're teaching in the classroom and link it to something that we can do in the outdoor classroom. And so we do a lot of planning together. We have a elementary science specialist that I work with, and we'll sit down and plan out the year of what outdoor lessons correlate with maybe what they're learning inside the four walls.
Inside the four walls,
yeah.
Wonderful. So let's talk some more about connecting the garden with K-5 curriculum. So if you could maybe go into some detail about some of the curricular connections here.
Yeah, so maybe we'll just kind of start with science because that is such a
robust. That's an easy spot.
That's an easy spot, and we have our next generation science standards that are very rigorous and really exciting because, you know, what they focus on is this concept of real world phenomenon, right? Observing it mm-hmm. and interacting with it, and what a better place than to be out in an outdoor setting, you know, with that real world phenomena right up in front of you. Here's an example. First graders now are supposed to learn about plant inheritance. You know, how, you know, adult plants and child plants look similar but not exactly the same. And that's a first grade mm-hmm. science standard. You know, they inherit some of those traits from their parent. And so, you know, the science specialist and I would get together and think about how are we going to do that in the outdoor classroom with our first graders? Well, maybe we're going to look at small tomato seedlings and mature tomato plants and compare the size of the leaves or the shades. Or maybe look at an agave plant and how it produces offspring and how that offspring is, you know, similar to mm-hmm. the parent plant. So, you know, once you have those standards and you think about your space, it really comes alive with how you can meet those. I mean, there's so many things with science we could talk about, you know, plant life cycles, about pollination. You know, we talk about erosion. We talk about soil structure. We talk about and learn about natural disasters and how plants might be able to resist some of the natural hazards that we have in our area, like wildfires.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond science, we have a lot of math standards that are pretty easy to integrate into the outdoor classroom, and we look at them by grade. This might be measuring the plant height of a sunflower with Unifix cubes in
mm-hmm.
kindergarten.
Okay.
It might be, you know, in fifth grade, you were looking over at our rain barrel system, and in fifth grade, our students calculate the rain catchment possibilities that could, you know, based on the square footage of our roof line and the volume of our rain barrels, how many inches of rain need to fall to fill those.
Wow.
And we presented as an inquiry, and you know, it's just there's so much, you know, even with the farmer's market that we mentioned, you know, a lot of weight and measurement.
And you said they get to set their prices too.
They set their prices.
And how do they determine that? What criteria do they use for price setting?
You know, a lot of times we have them do it by if they've already hit some of the math weight standards, you know, ounces or pounds. You know, we don't use pounds so much anymore, but you know, we'll have them weigh it and maybe decide whether they're going to price it per piece or they're going to price it by weight. And sometimes they'll say, okay, I'm going to charge $5 for this piece of shard. And so we say, okay, would you go and pay $5 of your allowance for that piece of shard? And then maybe they say, oh, maybe I'm going to charge less. So we really, it's
they
their space.
They think about it.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So connecting math and science to the garden is easy. What about things like reading and writing and those kinds of curricular areas?
There's lots of ways to do that. Some that come to mind that we've done in the past, you know, you don't want to have too many papers in your garden. You know, you want to have, clipboards are great because, you know, a lot of times you're observing, you're recording, you might be calculating like we just talked about, but you want it to feel different. You mm-hmm. want it to be a different experience than indoors in the classroom. But occasionally we still will read pieces, or maybe we'll read before we come out to the garden. For example, our fourth graders, they study obviously the California missions. They might read a couple passages about what the gardens on the missions looked like.
Mm.
Right? And they might read about what that life was like maybe how they protected their garden areas. Mm-hmm. They did it with, fallen tree branches and cholla cactus, and they might come with that background knowledge as we start to, integrate some of that into a lesson. Maybe we're, we have an olive tree and we'll have them pick olives and mm-hmm. try and, recreate making the olive oil.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of times it's background reading. Our fifth graders, they study a lot of colonial garden topics. And so reading about Jefferson's gardens at Monticello gives them a lot of context.
They get their background before they come here, and then that can lead to further questions in their study.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's fantastic. So talk a little bit about the way technology is incorporated into Top of the World. We've kind of touched on it, but you have two buildings out here, and tell us a little bit about them and the technology.
Yeah, well, we definitely have some green tech going on out here. Our equipment for this interview is plugged into a solar powered battery system mm-hmm. we have in our shed. A lot of school gardens maybe aren't close to a power source of the school, so we've engaged our high school solar club to come out, and they actually were the ones that did a couple project-based learning experiences to put solar into the garden. We have a plant tagging system that I mentioned. We use plant tags and QR codes for all of our perennials, and that's a really great tool. That QR code brings up another custom page that tells the student more about that plant, and they can use that for research reports or just curiosity. In terms of managing our program, we use a lot of technology. So not just in the education of the students, but in actually managing the school garden program. We use Google signups.
Uh-huh.
We use about 75 volunteers every year.
Wow.
And so it's a lot of just managing of people and times and
right that the technology can do. And then of course your geodome, we talked already about the technology that's involved in there. Do you have any funny stories about things that have happened in your outdoor classroom or in the garden? Besides the carrots, seeds blowing away, that makes me laugh because I can picture that.
I know, right? Okay, here's some more carrot seeds, Joey.
Yeah.
There's a lot of trial and error. When we first put in our geodome, the contractors that were helping us install it, they finished this pond. And we were so excited. We're going to have this hydroponic pond with fish and water-based plants. We had never had that before. Well, when they finished the pond was almost 5 feet tall.
Ah,
so
too
said,
tall.
How are the students, yeah. the elementary students, going to see the fish, right?
Yeah.
And so we said, no, we have to redo, we have to cut down the height of that pond to make it, child-centered. Mm-hmm. And the pond, after the first year we came back from the summer, despite all of our best efforts, trust me, coming every week and checking on the fish, and we had a heat snap and we had some floating fish, and the kids mm-hmm. come running out, Mrs. Osborne, there's a fish floating in the pond, we've improved a lot of our ability to care for our fish over the years, just through trial and error. And, we try and keep a light spirit about it.
Yeah, that's always good. You have to, especially when you're exploring and doing new things in the classroom. We talked a little bit about funding. Your PTA has made it a budget line item, which I think is an important bit of advice to give schools that are struggling with keeping their garden going. And you also said that you had the farmers market. Do you have any other sources of funding to keep this garden going?
I guess I would expand a little on the farmers market. That it's a funding source, but it's also this great annual event that demonstrates to the community what you have in your school. So maybe some families are engaged in the program and are coming, on during the week or on the weekends to help maintain it, but others, by virtue of the farmers market, get to see see what the students are growing. So it's really not just a financial piece, but it's really a community engagement piece. And I'll add that we sell a lot of products made from things in the garden.
Oh.
So typically, there's the produce, I'll call it the bulk produce, but each grade level Those the maybe the teachers or the parents that are involved will come up with something from that grade. Maybe they're going to make a sugar scrub that has some herbs from the first grade plot, or they're going to make a cookie that's made with the persimmons that students grow, and that adds a lot of profit, if you will, to the farmers market sale because they're homemade things.
Right, right, and that's awesome for students to get involved in that, because it gets them thinking, and I think that's the important thing. And you said grants, so there are grants out there, and you just have to search for garden grants to see if you can apply for one?
Yeah, and grants are a great way to get a garden going. You know, oftentimes they're a one-time infusion, and a lot of times they take a little bit of time to apply for and follow up on. But I definitely encourage, you know, looking at the grants that come out of Whole Foods, and, you know, doing some internet searches to see what you can find. The regular sustained funding year over year is what's important. Mm-hmm. So whether that's the PTA, the school district, the local garden club, you know, committing, you know, maybe $1,000 to $2,000 to make sure that there's money every year to buy seeds, soil amendments, that's, you know, replace tools. That's really important to sustain the program.
Yes, yeah, I see. This is obviously a tool and materials intensive class to run out here.
It is.
So how do you keep your garden going over the summer break?
Yeah, so we, you know, we have our handy dandy month by month garden activities, right? And you can even see, you know, we have a column for maintenance. And it says exactly, for example, in July, you know, we have some jobs. We have to cut back our artichokes. We have to put the sunscreen on our avocado trunks, and we have to clean out the shed. And so by writing down, you know, two or three things that need to get done over each of those summer months, you can do them yourself, or you can have a volunteer do them.
Do you get summer volunteers?
We do.
That's awesome. And so people would probably be satisfied coming in to do a project such as cleaning out the shed and then being done with it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of, you know, again, we're trying not to grow too many things that are true summer crops, but there's always stuff for those volunteers to take home, herbs and the such.
And so you have a drip irrigation system that's on a timer, and so that also helps keep your whole garden green if you do have herbs and things growing over the summer. So that would work. So you definitely, if you're developing a garden, you want a drip irrigation system.
Oh, without a doubt. That's, you know, when people ask for my advice, even in the pandemic, I got a lot of inquiries. I want to start a garden. And I say, do you have any irrigation? You know, so in a school garden, absolutely critical. There's school breaks, there's weekends.
Right.
Sometimes there's lack of access. You know, having drip irrigation, you know, even up here, we have it so we can turn off the drip line to a certain bed if there's nothing in that bed. Especially important over the summer. You know, maybe some beds are empty and some aren't. Really important to try and hone in that irrigation.
Yeah, and I can see that. And you also too mentioned that you have some plants that you can cut back, such as the artichokes. And when we were looking at the garden, you talk a little bit about the importance of having some food things that you can grow that come back year after year after year, and what those would be.
Yeah, so good question. So the artichokes are a great one. In our California climate, you know, you can, you know, our artichoke plants can be strong and vigorous for 5 or 6 years. They're a great plant for students because they're usually taller than most of my fifth graders. And, you know, they, at the end of the season, you cut them back, and, you know, they'll continue producing. So why that's important is, you know, you want to have plants that that are producing without sometimes as much effort. You know, growing annuals, you know, is a lot of, it's a lot of labor. And so by thinking about some edible perennials, you can really get, you can beautify your garden.
Oh, that's true.
Right, by having something that's there for much of the year. Some of the other things, I personally haven't had as much success, but I know that there's better gardeners than me, have had some success with asparagus.
Oh.
Yeah. I think that's like a 7 to 10 year perennial.
Mm-hmm.
We have some lemongrass that I was showing
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's huge.
It must be 10 feet tall, but that would be something we could cut back and it would come come back year after year. A couple other ideas might be sweet potatoes.
Mm.
Even though the kids pull them, they always seem to miss some, mm-hmm. and they seem to come back. The herbs, you know, a plentiful selection of your Mediterranean herbs is really a nice addition, worth the effort to plan out.
Yes, and if you have a farmer's market, herbs command a top price. So that's another thing to think about if you want to think about a farmer's market as a funding source for your school garden. So that's also a great idea. And you also talk a little bit about pests. And I know you have quite a few up here. Garden is fortunate to be fenced, but I think all gardens have to be fenced. In addition to the fencing, tell us a little bit more about your pest problems and what you've done to control them.
Yeah, so our pests range from rabbits, you know, our cute little bunnies that like to live in maybe some of the bushes on the slopes that surround our school, to rattlesnakes. Maybe the average gardener wouldn't think of scorpions as a pest, but in a school garden, mm-hmm. turning over a rock and finding scorpions, not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have rats. You know, another reason why we want to try and keep a clean garden, keep fallen fruit off the ground, you know, keep clutter to a minimum. School gardens always get tons of, you know, donated things, and that can kind of accumulate, and that's not a good thing.
Right, because rats love them. Yes,
they
do.
Also, a lot of times school gardens have sheds that are not secure, and that's really can be a problem. They have a little storage shed that doesn't securely close, and you know, rats can get in there to nest. So you really want to think about upgrading your storage to be as secure as possible with no gaps.
Mm-hmm.
We also have birds that can be pests to our berry crops and some of our stone fruit.
So you just build cages over your berry crops?
So on those, we use sparkly tape, you know, the bird scare tape, because, you know, the birds get some and we get some, so we're happy to share, and it kind of looks pretty.
Okay.
You know, for the rabbits, we use above ground cages.
Okay.
Kind of like a big box that goes over the raised bed, especially when a seedling might be in a really vulnerable stage.
Mm-hmm.
For the rattlesnakes, we talked about the fencing that's around the perimeter. You know, it's just probably unique to maybe a school setting that's on a wildland interface. We also have the snail and slug issue that every gardener has. And we always use, you know, the least invasive type of treatment.
Yes, and I guess, you know, the old wives' tale of a bowl of beer, you can't try it in elementary school.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. We did, actually, one year. And our principal came over one Monday morning, and he said, "Kelly, there's all these beer cans in the trash can in the garden. I don't know where these beer cans are coming from," right? Yeah, that could be a real cause for concern on campus. You know, I said, "Oh, you know, we were trying to see if that would help the snail and slug, you know, process as an experiment." But no, we typically use just an iron phosphate and all organic, easy to spread solution for the snail.
So as we get to the end of our program here, what advice do you have to schools that are trying to develop a garden curricular program and becoming part of their school cultures?
You know, I think, you know, start with the, there's usually a couple teachers or there's a couple staff members on campus that are really drawn to the outdoor space, that are drawn to natural phenomenon or interested in the program already, and forming that coalition of people that really want to grow the program into having some more rigorous curriculum integration is a really good first step. Here at Top of the World, it was really a priority from our leadership, from our principal, to, you know, have every class and every teacher out teaching in the garden. And one year he even said, you know, "I want everybody to teach at least 3 times in the outdoor classroom." And it was just as simple as him saying, you know, we have next gen science standards, we have Common Core, all of those emphasize real world learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so just give it a shot. And that really set the stage for it to be universal. And then, you know, refining it to really match the scope and the sequence of what's happening in the classroom so it's very timely was the way that teachers, at least at our site, really loved what the program could offer.
So it worked, and it sounds like the teacher buy-in. And I like what you said earlier about creating an outdoor space that's calming for teachers to take a break in and have their lunch in. That's an awesome idea that I hadn't even thought about.
Mm-hmm.
Children spend less and less time outdoors, and it's taking a toll on their health and well-being. Research has shown that children do better physically and emotionally when they are in green spaces. A new trend is emerging to implement gardens into a school's curriculum and to help restore the broken bond between children and nature. We can learn and build upon what Kelly has done here. It's been a pleasure talking with you today, Kelly, and I've learned a lot, and I'm sure all the listeners have too. So to learn more about Top of the World School Garden, I want to give the website again. It's an easy one to remember. It's TOW, T-O-W, for Top of the World, and then the word garden, all one word, .org. And that's as easy as it can be, and there's a wealth of information and contacts and things if you want to go further than what we discussed in this program today. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on the show, visit kuci.org. You've been listening to In the Garden on 88.9 KUCI Irvine.
Seeds, soil, water, sun. Soil, water, sun, that's all you need to grow a plant. First you find a spot that gets a lot of sun. Most plants like about 6 to 8 hours of sun. Take a garden fork and loosen up the soil. Be kind to the worms that come up in the soil. If the soil is weak, then you must amend. Compost, manure, or cocoa coir is what you add. Seeds, soil, water, sun. Seeds, soil, water, sun. That's all you need to grow a plant. Now it's time, take a seed, put it in the soil. How deep you better know before you plant so it can grow. Little seeds stay close to the top of the soil. Big seeds go deeper down into the soil. Spread some mulch over top, make your plants happy. Mulch keeps water in so plants don't get too thirsty. Sun.